Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Japan's prime minister urges the U.S. Congress to support the Pacific Trade Pact. Saudi Arabia's king places a new generation of leaders first in the line of succession. And the death toll in Nepal's earthquake surpasses 6,000. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, David Sanger of the New York Times, Missy Ryan of the Washington Post, and David Rothkopf with Foreign Policy Group, which publishes Foreign Policy Magazine, joining the News Roundup for the first time. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850. We'll open the phones in just a few minutes. You can always shoot us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So the Japanese prime minister was in town this week on a state visit. David Rothkopf, was much accomplished?
Well, I think there was some progress, particularly in an area that I don't think has gotten as much attention as it should, which has to do with defense cooperation and giving the Japanese a little bit more latitude to adopt a normal defense posture, not just self-defense. And I think over the next several years, they're going to get closer and closer to that, and that's going to have big implications for their relationship with China. On the trade front, where they wanted to have a lot of progress, there was some nice talk. But behind the scenes, especially up on Capitol Hill, the prospects of Trade Promotion Authority started looking a little dimmer. And that's of course, of great concern to the administration that was hoping that this was going to be their great summer where they were going to get an Iran nuclear deal and a Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, and they just had the Cuba deal, and they were going to be on a roll in foreign policy for the first time in, well, ever.
The Japanese prime minister talked about this Pacific trade deal as a way to counter China's influence. Missy, does that seem persuasive to members of Congress who are looking at whether to allow this deal to go forward with the fast-track authority?
So, like other Democratic presidents, Obama is facing opposition from his own party to the trade deal from members who feel that it will degrade workers' rights and environmental standards. So I think, no, it's, you know, as David said, it's going to be, I think, a close call.
You know, we heard from listeners in our first hour talking about the Pacific Trade Pact as an example of something like NAFTA, according to these listeners, that has hurt American communities such as Baltimore by hurting the manufacturing sector. You know, I gathered, David Sanger, that you were in Korea at the time of the prime minister's address to Congress. We were listening for an apology for wartime atrocities. Did we hear one?
No, you didn't. And I think that anybody who had expected that you would get one probably had not been picking up the signals from the prime minister and his camp. Remember, he comes from an extremely conservative segment of the Japanese political spectrum that has long opposed not only an apology, but has denied that Japan was responsible for the treatment of what's now known euphemistically as the comfort women. These were women who were basically made sex slaves of the Japanese troops. And the questions come down to whether the state organized that or whether these women went there on some private basis or went there organized by non-state groups. And I think anybody who has read much about the history of Japan during that period of time finds it almost inconceivable that they would have been there without the organization of the Japanese military. He edged toward this by talking about taking responsibility. But this was all done in very careful wording. I was in Japan about a month ago and was seeing some members of his staff, and they were already drafting the language and then drafting how you would translate the language so that it sounded slightly better in English than it would necessarily back in Japanese.
And what did the Koreans feel about what the Japanese prime minister said?
You know, it's interesting because, as David pointed out, the defense element of what he actually agreed to, and I'll come back to that in a second, was the most important thing and the thing that you would have thought might have incensed the South Koreans the most, since they worry about Japan almost as much as they worry about China. And instead, all they could discuss was the apology, which they found, or non-apology, which they found completely wanting. Let's turn for a second back to this defense issue. What it essentially says is that Japan will abandon the concept that it would only act in complete self-defense and instead could act in collective self-defense with other allies, including the United States, which means out-of-area operations, not just off of the Japanese shore. This issue has been kicking around in Japan, well, since I lived there in the late 80s and early 90s, and it gets to the question of the point at which they will become a normal nation. And the fact that they managed to get this, and this was sort of last-minute negotiations that Ash Carter, the new defense secretary, did with the Japanese, I think was a significant step forward. And the fact that the Chinese didn't scream too loud about it tells you that they prepared the ground for it pretty well.
And it's an example, just both with the apology and with the defense agreement, about how you're still dealing with the consequences of a war that ended decades
70 years
decades
ago.
70 years ago.
Yeah. Well, and it's inevitable that Japan does normalize. And it is also inevitable that in the context of the 21st century, what that means is Japan versus China. And, you know, we see this as a way of stabilizing the region and having Japan pick up a little of the weight in the counterbalancing of China. But their relationship is pretty volatile. They have their own bones to pick that go back to World War II. A more active Japan in the region could spark other kinds of issues that we don't control and that don't serve our interests.
Missy.
Just to add, I think the defense guidelines actually underscore the fact as well that in the military arena, the Obama administration has had more success than in other arenas in its pivot to Asia so far. And, you know, they've really been struggling to refocus attention away from the foreign policy crises in the Middle East. And the fact that they were able to update these defense guidelines in a way that actually provide enhanced protection to American troops in the region against, for example, a North Korean threat is, I think, a good news for the Pentagon.
David Sanger, we've seen the White House step up its lobbying campaign on behalf of the Pacific Trade Agreement. Are they going to get it over the finish line, do you think?
I think they probably will, but if they do, it's only because the Republicans, as Missy suggested before, decide that the issue is so great that they're willing to give Barack Obama a victory. And so that is not a decided factor. You know, there's sort of two ways to look at these agreements. You can either sell them as of strategic import, which is how Bill Clinton in the end managed to sell NAFTA. And he barely made it through. And I thought at that time that he had perhaps along the way changed the way his own party thought about trade and moved them more to the strategic element and less to thinking about this merely as a domestic and jobs issue. I was totally wrong. And the debate that's going on now tells you that the Democratic Party really has not moved on this issue since NAFTA's passage, even though if you go back and you look at what was said about NAFTA on both sides when it was passed, it has neither had the great benefits that were touted. It's had many benefits, but not the grand, nor has it had the disastrous effects that the Democrats who opposed it said it would.
I was a trade official during the Clinton administration and lived through the NAFTA, the NAFTA drama and the subsequent drama. In fact, that's where I met David Sanger a long time ago. And he's completely unchanged in the years, by the way. But the arguments are exactly the same. And in fact, the opposition to TPP that you hear says, well, they promised this with NAFTA and we lost jobs. They promised this with the deal with China and we lost jobs. They're promising the same thing again, that we're going to gain jobs and we are likely to lose jobs. The reality is this. TPP is not what either side is selling it as. It's a modest deal. It produces modest benefits. It is likely to have a modest impact. And the main reason the TPP could be significant is that China at some point might aspire to be part of TPP and thus raise its game in terms of its standards. But we are a long, long way from that. And in fact, the Chinese economic play for Asia is actually driving the game. And for us, TPP is a bit of catch-up.
Well, as someone who has some experience in trying to get these trade pacts through and for a Democratic president facing reluctant Democratic members of Congress, do you think it gets over the finish line?
I think it's very close. I agree with David. I think in the end, it's likely that it will, simply because the White House is actually putting its shoulder into this in a way that it has not with certain things in the past. But, you know, trade is interesting. It requires an alliance of the Democratic center and the Republican center against the Democratic left and the Republican right. And unlike back in the day of NAFTA, the Republican right is a little bit bigger, a little bit more active. The Tea Party doesn't much like this deal. And so when you have the Tea Party and the Bernie Sanders or the Sherrod Browns of this world lining up against these things, you know, that can be more formidable than what we've seen as opposition. So I think, as Missy said, this is hanging on a thread right now.
And you can hear it in the way Hillary Clinton talks about this, because when she was Secretary of State, she was full-throated in the need for this as a way to build our alliances
in
Asia.
The gold standard, she called it.
The gold standard, that's right. And today, I detect a little less enthusiasm.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the U.S. and Iran and why the United States is now accompanying some American flagged ships into the Strait of Hormuz, what that might mean for those Iran nuclear talks. We'll take your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, a service designed to help consumers fix and improve their homes. Visitors can get project support and schedule appointments with local contractors online or with the Angie's List iPhone and Android apps. More at angieslist.com. From the Maine Office of Tourism, which offers travelers an opportunity to explore and discover their main thing, to be inspired, be adventurous, and be yourself. The journey begins at visitmaine.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, we're joined by David Rothkopf. He's CEO and editor of the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy magazine. He's the author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And David Sanger, he's national security correspondent for the New York Times. He's the author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. And we're also joined by Missy Ryan. She covers the Pentagon for the Washington Post. And Missy, this week you have written about the U.S. decision to accompany some American flagged ships into the Strait of Hormuz. What is happening there?
So on Wednesday, the Maersk Tigris, which was a Marshall Islands flagship, was intercepted by Iranian Revolutionary Guards Forces Navy ships. And it was escorted, after being fired upon, closer to Iran and is now anchored off the Iranian coast. The ship, which didn't have any American crew members but had a sort of international crew and was carrying commercial cargo, was boarded by Iranian forces. And now it's essentially waiting there for a response from the company to an Iranian court's demand that they pay $3.6 million for a dispute over cargo, essentially. But really what this incident underscores is the unpredictability of Iran's military, Iran's forces, and the lack of, and sort of the opacity of the decision-making process in Iran at a moment where the United States is not only trying to advance the nuclear talks, but also dealing with Iranian proxies and their influence, and everywhere from Syria to Iraq to Yemen.
David Rothkopf, is this a risky decision by the United States?
I don't think this is a risky decision. I think one might argue that a riskier decision would be putting the nuclear deal ahead of putting efforts to counterbalance Iran at the top of the list of American priorities in the region, because Iran is being so aggressive in so many places right now, whether it's in Syria or whether it's in Iraq, where they're, you know, effectively have gained control with the government there through their support of it, or whether it is in Yemen. And in fact, what's going on in Yemen has made many, many of our traditional allies in the region extremely uncomfortable, precisely because the Iranian efforts to expand their influence in the region has extended over 35 years and is now on the verge of actually surrounding them. Because to the extent to which they can gain any control of any portion of Yemen, that sort of boxes in the states and the Gulf. And we're at a moment, I think it's fair to say, where the tension between our traditional allies in the Gulf, the Sunni states, and Iran, is at a new high and is quite dangerous.
Well, do you agree, David? Dangerous?
I do. I was, as you mentioned before, I was in Korea and I ran into Prince Turki, the former Saudi.
Like on the street?
No, we were at a conference together. we were just at a Starbucks, right? He was at this conference I was attending much more strident in public about Iran's gains than I have ever heard him before. So in the past, he has always said, look, anything that you give the Iranians in the nuclear deal, we will build as well. Okay, so making the point that the deal itself could trigger some proliferation in the region. In this time, he said that, and then he said a series of blistering comments about the Obama administration not being willing to counter just what David was describing, this series of Iranian acts across the region. And I think that we have been sort of so focused on the nuclear deal and Iran and Israel that we have to some degree discounted the possibility that you could end up seeing a conflict between the Iranians and the Saudis and others that go beyond what you're seeing happen in a proxy form in Yemen.
I think one could argue that Iranian influence across the region, military influence, is at an all-time high. And, you know, there are historic reasons that the United States hasn't pushed back, for example, against, you know, Hezbollah in Lebanon for reasons wanting to preserve regional stability. But certainly Obama administration critics would argue, and I think plausibly, that it's actually sort of a watershed moment and things are different now.
And one of the things that happened this week was a sudden and rather remarkable change in the power structure in Saudi Arabia, where you saw King Salman, who many people thought was going to sort of dodder through his, you know, his custodianship of the king, king's role there, taking another set of very strong acts, which involved promoting Mohammed bin Nayef to be the crown prince, promoting his son, Mohammed bin Salman, to be the deputy crown prince. These are both very different from past Saudi leaders in that they are decisive, bold, inclined towards Saudi policy independent of American policy, and representative, particularly in the case of Mohammed bin Salman, of the younger generation in Saudi Arabia. And a lot of what they're doing comes in reaction to what David and Missy are talking about.
You think that's why he chose to take these steps dealing with succession?
I think it has to do with succession and strengthening his hold. But I think that the level of concern within the Saudi elites about the state of the Middle East right now, the rise of Iran, the apparent pullback of the United States, their uncertainty about what's happening in Iraq and in Yemen, has essentially forced their hand to move up the A-team as they see the A-team sooner than they might have otherwise.
So is this of concern to the United States and U.S. interests, do you think, David Sanger?
Well, I think the concern here is that American influence over how the Saudis operate may be diminishing. And you saw a little bit of that with the Saudi decision first to bomb in Yemen, then to stop bombing as there was a brief chance of some kind of political dialogue, and then almost immediately to resume it again. This is a level of activism by the Saudis that we have rarely seen in the region. Usually when they wanted to influence the region, you know, 10 years ago, it had to do with what they would do with oil prices, you know, pumping more to allow the sanctions on Iran. I don't think that you have seen this kind of military involvement by the Saudis in a long time.
And I think the fact that the United States has provided some level of military assistance to the Saudi campaign, despite the fact that they haven't gotten all the information in a timely way, and despite the fact that there have, for example, been reports of pretty significant numbers of civilian casualties, underscores the fact that this is a moment where the Obama administration really can't afford to anger Saudi Arabia any more than it already has, and it knows that because of the Iran deal.
And what we're going to see in a couple of weeks is the GCC leaders coming to Camp David to talk. And right now, behind the scenes, there is a negotiation going on where essentially the GCC are saying to the U.S., well, how much do you love us?
And the GCC is?
The Gulf Cooperation Council. So it's the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, a bunch of these other countries that are nervous about Iran. And so they're saying, if you really are committed to containing Iran, if you are really committed to us as allies, show us, don't tell us. Give us the weapon systems we need. Create a pact, perhaps, that gives us the guarantee that you'll step up and be on our side when the problems come. And there is, you know, this is going to be a deal that is going to be measured in terms of whether the Emiratis get F-35 fighters and how soon after the Israelis, the Emiratis get the F-35 fighters, things like that.
Also, what David's saying is absolutely right, and this is all going to play out at Camp David in the second week of May. But the other interesting question is whether there is increasing discussion of extending an American nuclear umbrella over the Arab states, something that Secretary Clinton discussed briefly, I think, on one of her first trips to the Arab world as secretary in 2009, and then that discussion disappeared from American dialogue. My suspicion is you'll see it back.
But Americans seems, the Obama administration at least, seems focused most of all on if they can get finished with this nuclear deal with Iran by June 30th. Does that figure in the calculations and everything else?
It does. And so we saw a few interesting things happen on this front as well this week. So the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, was in New York. He was there for the opening of the five-year review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And that itself was symbolic because he was making the point that Iran is a member and that Israel is not, and he denounced the Israeli nuclear weapons program and called again for a nuclear-free Middle East, which is their way of saying that Israel must give up its nuclear weapons, something the U.S. is hardly going to embrace. He went on Charlie Rose. He did a public interview that David Ignatius frequently at this table conducted with him. And during this time, he made it sound as if the deal was certainly within reach. But Secretary Kerry has got to be worried that in these next 2 months, having set this June 30th deadline, that the Iranians are going to come back and say, I know you think we agreed to this, this, and this, but we have to pull back a few of these. And there's an interesting behind-the-scenes debate going on within the administration about whether sticking to that June 30th deadline is in American interests or not, or because they believe the Iranians will probably hold back on any final concessions until after that deadline is passed.
Ms. Ryan. I just want to add one other thing regarding American Gulf relations, and this is certainly going to be another subject of conversation in these upcoming meetings, which is the longstanding desire by some Gulf countries for more muscular American policy, more muscular involvement in Syria. And we are supposedly at the cusp of the start of this new training program where U.S. military officials are going to be training Syrian rebels in Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Jordan. And this is about to begin, but at the same time, the countries that are hosting these programs continue to have differences in what the objectives are, and that's certainly to be front and center in the Gulf conversations as well.
Let's talk to Jim. He's calling us from Tacoma Park, Maryland. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Great. For Mr. Rothkopf, I was really interested. I've been following this trade thing very closely. I'm a journalist here in the area, and I was very taken by your assertion that the TPP is much less potent than NAFTA and the deal with Korea was, and that's interesting, and I certainly consider you very credible on that score. But one thing I'd be interested in, one of the major criticisms of it is the fact that some of the details that have not been made public relate to two things: arbitration of differences under the TPP, and apparently these leaks indicate, or more than indicate, they say that the arbitration would be done by the corporations themselves. And the other thing is that the treaty could very much relax international control and regulation of financial institutions, and I'd be interested in your reaction to that.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call.
Well, you know, one of the criticisms that has been leveled by a number of people is that there is allegedly this provision within the deal that will allow an arbitration provision that would allow foreign companies not to have to adhere to U.S. law, but they could sort of refer to this other body. And I think we're going to have to wait and see exactly what the terms of this deal are. And I'm not exactly sure whether that's even enforceable under U.S. law. But it's the kind of rumor that opponents of the deal or argument that opponents of the deal have been trying to spread to stop it. In terms of financial regulations, it's not an area of the deal that I'm highly familiar with. But again, I don't think that where we're headed with this deal is lesser regulation in these areas. And I don't think that the Obama administration is going to reverse its stance on regulation.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls 1-800-433-8850. Well, Missy, we saw a devastating earthquake rock Nepal last Saturday, thousands of people dead. What are conditions like on the ground now?
By all our reports, the conditions are dire. International aid workers have begun to arrive, but they're having difficulties reaching the outlying areas. And it's the same story we always see in these kind of earthquakes and natural disasters, especially in developing countries, which is problems with coordination of different aid efforts, the weakness of the central government in terms of providing for basic security, basic needs of their people in the wake of something that, you know, perhaps exceeded the expectations of local authorities who, you know, had taken some steps and precautions for an earthquake. And it's quite sad. The U.S. government has sent several cargo aircraft with urban search and rescue teams, including a rescue team here from Fairfax, Virginia. And they've, you know, I think that they've done some good work. They helped pull a teenager out of the rubble, and he had been trapped for 5 days. So obviously that's a success story, but certainly there are a lot of people who are still waiting for medical assistance. And of course, we're going to have to be looking out for the threat of communicable disease as this tragedy unfolds.
Do we learn things? Does the world learn things from one disaster to the next that get applied, or do we just seem to relive the same experience when it comes to these terrible natural disasters?
Well, I think certainly the U.S. has learned a lot, and we have a lot of pre-positioned disaster relief now that we did not 10 years ago. And it's pretty remarkable when you're at a place like Pearl Harbor and you see how much they have ready to airlift out. And this is, they've done this with earthquakes in China. They've done this, obviously, in the tsunami in Indonesia and other places. In this case, as Missy suggested, you know, there is one airport in Kathmandu that has one runway and room at this airport. It's like landing at a small regional airport in the United States. There's room for 5 or 6 big planes, maybe. And so they literally don't have a place to go put all these. Meanwhile, they have huge lines of people who are just trying to get out because there's not food, there's not running water and so forth, and that's just in the city. And then, of course, you need a lot of helicopter capacity to get up into these villages. Remember, the earthquake was centered about 40 or 50 miles from Kathmandu. So there's, a lot of villages that have just been wiped out.
I think your assertion, though, that we don't seem to learn may be more true than it's not.
I was mostly asking. I wasn't really asserting, but go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, in response to your question, I think that, it may be more true than not. You know, look at what happens in poor countries when disasters strike. Whether we are a little bit better equipped to come in after the disaster doesn't really have an effect on the vast majority of people affected, the vast majority of lives lost, the vast majority of property damage. In the middle of Kathmandu, I believe you had the Nepalese National Library, which stood while everything around it fell. Why? Because the library had been shored up against potential earthquakes, and all the buildings around it had not been shored up. And I don't think we place enough focus in our development programs on ensuring that these regions can withstand these crises before they happen.
Our thoughts are certainly with the people in Nepal. I know a lot of Americans and a lot of our listeners are curious about what they can do to help. We've talked to some organizations. They say you shouldn't go to Nepal or send goods to Nepal. The best thing you do is send money to a legal and vetted organization. And the GiveWell blog recommends Doctors Without Borders as well as local Red Cross groups if you'd like to help. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll talk about the disclosure that the FBI helped with a hostage ransom payment, possibly at odds with U.S. policy. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from The Forward, a newspaper and website for Jewish perspectives on news, culture, and opinion. This week, The Forward follows author Sigal Samuel to Mumbai, where she searches for her Jewish roots and lands a part in a Bollywood film, at forward.com. From the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
You're still making your nice little pictures, Mr. Turner.
Mr. Turner, the film about the British painter J.M.W. Turner, will be released on DVD next week. On the next Fresh Air, our interview with the film's star, Timothy Spall. His performance won him the Best Actor Prize at Cannes and a New York Film Critics Circle Award. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio, Missy Ryan, Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post, David Rothkopf, CEO and editor of the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy Magazine, and David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Let's take some calls from our listeners. We'll go first to Doug, who's calling us from Naperville, Illinois. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Susan. Thank you for accepting my call. Be grateful if the panel could talk about and remember and reflect Richard Holbrooke, was very moved by Matthew Rosenberg's story in the New York Times, and then the letter from Richard Holbrooke's Katie Martin, his wife, about the documentary of The Diplomat. And two brief thoughts. One was just the sadness of that Richard Holbrooke and President Obama and the White House couldn't work together in 2008 and 2009? What a difference does the panel think it might have made in ultimately in Afghanistan and Pakistan, remembering what Richard Holbrooke had accomplished at the Dayton Accords in bringing peace there? And then secondly, Roger Cohen, I think, column in the fall just made me feel very sad that the petition was made for Richard Holbrooke to be buried in Arlington Cemetery because he'd given his life to American diplomacy and foreign policy, and that President Obama and the White House did not, at least either directly or indirectly, support that. So thank you. Be grateful for the panel's remembrance reflections on Richard Holbrooke.
All right, Doug, thanks for your call. I think all of us knew Richard Holbrooke. He was a real force of nature. David?
He was, and these new tapes that have come out, which Matt Rosenberg wrote a fascinating story in the Times about, were basically an audio diary that he was keeping the last year of his life as he was trying to get a larger role for his he was a special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, but he also had hopes of trying to work out a Pakistan-India kind of accord at that time, and he wanted greater ability to deal with the Taliban. Mr. Holbrooke was somebody who saw himself in historic terms, as we know. There was more than a little bit of ego there, but it was frequently ego that was matched with great talent. He was somebody with whom he and President Obama never got on the same wavelength, and there are many stories. I've written some of them in my books. I think David has some of this in National Insecurity, where at NSC meetings you would hear President Obama tweak him at various moments for what he perceived as pomposity. The big question that your caller raised was, would it have made a big difference had Mr. Holbrooke been given greater license? And we will never know the answer to that. My guess is that the forces that he was up against were probably so great that the American influence in this particular arena would not have necessarily been that great. And the characters he was dealing with, including President Karzai in Afghanistan, who drove him up the wall, probably would have resisted a good number of his efforts.
Holbrooke was a great guy. He was a force of nature. He was brilliant. He devoted his whole life to these issues. And it's a real tragedy of this administration, not just that his life was lost, but that the service he could have provided ended up not being provided because of the breakdown in the relationship between him and the White House. David's right. There were plenty of instances where he was dressed down publicly by the president, or shots were taken. He would say something, and the president would say, do people really speak like that? And this ate at Holbrooke, who is a man of great pride. But there's a bigger issue here, because it's not just about Holbrooke. Holbrooke is a perfect example of the kind of dedicated, experienced public servant that if he were entrusted with power, autonomy, responsibility that was something that he could follow through on, he could have done a lot more than if the White House kept a tight rein on him. And this White House has had as one of its core problems, not something political, but simply a management problem of not empowering the very qualified members of its administration fully enough to do their job, act autonomously, and deal with the broad array of problems that we face. So Holbrooke's is a tragedy, but there's a flaw within the administration that it illustrates that really ought to be paid more attention to.
I think another thing that's interesting about Richard Holbrooke is that he, in my mind, epitomizes a lot of the characteristics of early Obama administration foreign policy, first of which the desire to go in big in Afghanistan and turn that conflict around. You had the troop surge. You had the civilian surge, which Richard Holbrooke was very much involved in. Really big ambitions for Afghanistan after years in which it was sort of overlooked. Secondly, he also epitomized the interagency conflicts and the sort of kinks that I think were later worked out to a large extent between senior officials and the Obama administration team. And finally, frankly, some self-inflicted wounds, too, in terms of a few miscalculations regarding what First of all, the United States could accomplish in Afghanistan. And then I think some instances where the United States unnecessarily aggravated relations with President Karzai.
Doug raised the issue of his burial at Arlington Cemetery. I'm not familiar with that controversy. Are you, David?
I am not, but I just wanted to pick up on what Missy and David mentioned, which is that when you spoke to Holbrooke in the last few months of his life about what he thought he might accomplish, he was driven by two dramatic experiences in his own life, being a young Foreign Service officer in Vietnam and seeing the mistakes that we made there, and then the success of the Dayton Accords, which made him believe, and perhaps overbelieve, in the powers of his own persuasion, abilities to persuade warring allies to sort of warring adversaries to come together. And I wonder whether or not, had, as David suggested, he'd been given a little more leash, whether it would have actually changed the way the Obama administration perceived its intervention efforts in the first term, which were all about the light footprint. They were all about trying to go in a casualty-free way. And I think Richard didn't believe that was necessarily possible.
Well, if whatever his shortcomings, he did a lot for this nation, devoted his life to it, and we remember him. Let's go to James. He's calling us from Charlottesville, Virginia. James, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for taking my call. The parallel has been made between this new trade pact and one we made with South Korea. Now, I'm not much familiar with the terms of the South Korean one, but I now see all of our stores flooded with Samsung, home appliances, all kinds of electronics gear and everything else that all comes from South Korea. And yet these are the things that we often tout as being the core of a growing house, home ownership industry. How much will this same bleeding of industry and associated jobs to Southeast Asia occur with this new TPP? Seems to me like it's redo all over again.
With James, thanks so much for your call. Let me read an email we got from Judy in Detroit. She writes, one of my relatives lost three jobs directly due to NAFTA. Production went to Mexico. The legislators supporting the so-called free trade are not really for agreements that do not include U.S. government subsidies for the businesses involved. That is, they are not in favor of actual free trade at all. We hear a lot of concern about the impact.
Well, look, first of all, I think I was one of the people in the Clinton administration that was out selling NAFTA, and I think we oversold NAFTA. I think we suggested that the benefits were going to be more than they actually were going to be, And I also think we underplayed the potential dislocations that are come as a result of globalization in international markets, and we need to do more about it. Having said that, most of the jobs that we have lost have not been outsourced to other countries. They've been outsourced to the past. These jobs aren't being done. They're being done by robots. They're being done by computers. They are being done by hyper-productivity. And what we have to do is we have to identify where we have a comparative advantage going forward. We don't want the jobs that people say are off in Asia. We don't necessarily benefit from those jobs. We have to think about, in the economy of the future, where we can add value, how we can train our people to add value, what kind of infrastructure we need in order to give the people the competitive tools they need to attract foreign direct investment and build the businesses of tomorrow in this country. And so it's really a question of, do we focus on the jobs of the past or do we focus on the jobs of the future?
Yeah, David's exactly right that, you know, we tend to have this very static conversation about trade as if appliances, which were a significant part of the American economy in the 1950s, are, you know, going to be a booming part, you know, for the next 20 years. And in fact, some appliance production has come back to the United States because people have moved to larger appliances and smarter appliances. You've seen companies begin to resume some production here. But I think the more important question isn't looking at what looks to be Korean branded here in the United States. It's what looks to be American branded in Korea, now the 13th or 14th largest economy. And every time I go to Korea, I see more presence of foreign goods and American goods than I used to see when I lived in Asia 20 years ago. And that is, to some degree, really how you measure some of the net success of these kind of agreements.
just to add, I think it's going to be interesting to see whether how big an issue this is going to be in the early 2016 presidential conversations. And I think the key thing that I will be looking for is whether it becomes a proxy for the whole inequality debate. And if it does, then I think that you could see a lot more sort of public feeling injected into the conversation about a new trade deal with Asia.
But by the way, there are other things to worry about here. You know, something like 75-80% of the chipsets that go into an F-35 fighter are made in Asia, not made here. 70% of the active pharmacological ingredients in drugs taken in the United States are made in China, not here. In other words, we are growing increasingly dependent on certain strategic things from Asia, and I think we have to keep an eye on that because there's some danger in it.
Let's go to Princeton, New Jersey, and talk to Suma. Suma, hi. Thank you for calling us.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. And my comment has to do with the new Obama foreign policy for the Middle East, which I think it's a paradigm shift from the past in the sense that the Saudis and other allies have depended on American lives and American young men and American resources to fight the battles for them whenever they are faced with threat from either terrorists or threats from their neighbors. But this time Obama is saying, in as much as we may have some threats from these terrorists, but the threat is far more serious on your part than us. So instead of us sending American lives, you need to step up and show that you are serious about taking responsibility of your own threat, and then we will give you support wherever we can. And I think that's the best foreign policy approach, because the biggest foreign policy blunder we have made in a century is this Iraq foreign policy that has emboldened the Chinese, has emboldened the Russians, because they have exposed our weakness. And that's what Obama is trying to prevent.
All right, Suma, thanks for your call. You know, you've got David Rothkopf shaking his head in disagreement, I think.
Well, look, I mean, it's not a choice between the idiocy of the Bush administration and pulling back completely from taking responsibility for the relationships and the alliances that we have in this administration. There is a more sensible middle ground, and I think we have to keep in mind that if we turn our backs on our allies, they will turn to other people. If we turn our backs on our allies, they will seek other forms of influence. The last point I want to make is, think about this. The number one trading partner of Iran and Saudi Arabia right now is China. The number two trading partner of Israel and Pakistan right now is China. There is another shift going on, and we've got to be aware of that as well.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls and reading your questions. But let's talk for a moment about the story this week. The FBI helped facilitate a ransom payment to try to free an American who's being held by al-Qaeda. This is notable, David Sanger, because the U.S. has a pretty strict policy against paying ransom for hostages.
The U.S. does. And the concept behind the policy against paying ransom is that once a country becomes known for paying ransom, the theory is it will increase the number of people from that country who end up getting kidnapped. I mean, it's a pure market calculation. That works as an overall policy. It doesn't work as an individual policy, which is to say, if it's your son or daughter, your husband or wife who has been taken, you're suddenly a lot less interested in setting the precedent forward and a lot more interested in getting them out. And if these reports are right about the role the FBI played in advising, it strikes me as probably a well-intentioned effort to help a family that was probably going to go ahead and do this anyway. It's pretty inconceivable that we would end up prosecuting a family for paying a ransom to get back their son or daughter.
Now, Missy, the FBI didn't pay the ransom,
that's
but
right.
It helped
right.
facilitate, help
they
the family
vetted
arrange.
A middleman, yeah. A Pakistani intermediary, who then received, I think it was $250,000 from the Weinstein family, apparently delivered it, but he was never returned to his family. But what I think that this really underscores is the inconsistency, or at least the ambiguity of the Obama administration's policy regarding hostages. And as everyone here knows, there's a review ongoing at the White House of American hostage policy, and there have been some calls to create a hostage czar. But you can really understand, if you are Jim Foley's family, how angry you would be. The Foley family and other families of American hostages overseas were told that they could be prosecuted for paying a ransom for their family members. And then this is revealed. And it would just be so heartbreaking to think that maybe there was something you could have done that you didn't do.
A hostage czar sound like a good idea to you, David Rothkopf?
We come up with czars when we don't have consistent policy. You know, this administration has appointed more czars than the Romanovs had. It's not the answer to the question. I think what we need is a real policy. We don't have a policy. And I think if you talk to the Foley family, the Sotloff family, the Mueller family, the Weinstein family, what you would get behind the scenes is anger. Anger that they got mixed messages, anger that people dragged their feet, anger that the outcomes were bad outcomes, anger that Bo Bergdahl got, you know, Missy had a very good story on what's happening now to the five guys who were traded to Bo Bergdahl.
What is happening to them, Missy?
So the supervision period and the travel ban for the five Taliban detainees, who were transferred to Qatar last May 31st is expiring at the end of this month. And the question is, what happens to them then? They're not currently allowed to travel, for example, back to Afghanistan, but they could be. And so there's negotiations happening between the U.S. and Qatari governments about possibly extending at least some of that arrangement.
Let's close with an email we've gotten from David. He writes, "May I encourage more self-reflection and less reference to the supposed shortcomings of other nations? Nepal is disorganized? Think Katrina. Poor countries should shore up their buildings, take a look at U.S. bridges and highways and other infrastructure bits." David, thanks so much for your contribution. My thanks also to the two Davids on our panel, David Sanger of the New York Times, David Rothkopf of FP Group, and also to Missy Ryan of the Washington Post. Thank you all for being with us this hour. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.